You're listening to the second part of a multi-part series entitled God of Gods by Dante Stack, a look into the polytheistic roots and environment in which the Old Testament of the Bible was written. Today's episode is part two. What is an angel? Begin now. This is 365 Honest Questions About the Bible. I'm your long-suffering host, Dante Stack, and today we're on question 80, what is an angel? And we are on part two of our sub-series, God of Gods. So, if you were with us for part one, we were zooming in on the definition of the word God. In particular, how that word is used in the Old Testament of the Bible. And kind of the takeaway from that was there's a few words that are used all the time, namely El, Adonai, Yahweh, and Elohim. Now, the most used word in that four-word namology of God is the word Elohim. The problem with Elohim is that it seems to apply to a lot more than the one God of Israel. It seems to apply to all these other things out there. So this series is trying to grapple with that reality that there are multiple Elohim, which is a word that we should probably always translate as God. Sometimes our Bibles do, sometimes it doesn't. This series is looking at what happens if we do always define Elohim as gods. How does that change our reference point? And what else is going on here in the Old Testament in particular, and the Bible as a whole, that maybe our English-speaking lens misses because of this, I don't want to say mistranslation, but boxed-in translation. And then as a greater whole, we're also looking at the context in which the God of Israel swoops into play here in the history of the world and what's going on in Mesopotamia and around the Jewish people when the God of Israel comes in. Is there also a way to look at the Old Testament and all these syncretisms, for instance, the word El also being the highest, most prominent god of the Canaanite religion, the multi-theistic, similar to, you know, Greek god pantheon that the Canaanites had, the god El was the highest, most high god. The god El was the one that Baal, who you see ripped to shreds all over the Old Testament, actually pays homage to on multiple occasions in that Canaanite religion. How is it okay that the Israel God also uses that same word El to describe himself? He says he is an El. And then he uses that word and connects it to other descriptors like El Shaddai, El Elyon. Is that just syncretism? Israel taking what they want from the Canaanites and being like, all right, we'll use this word to describe our Yahweh? Or is something else happening? Obviously, I'm trying to make a case for the latter. And once I make that case, we're just going to weigh into how that changes our perception of the ancient world. Now, that's my previously on. Time for the preamble to this question that we're dealing with. We're dealing with angels today, and I'm about to describe why. Quick note here, my preamble is probably just about as long as my actual content for this episode. Because just important to me in this process, it's not just about conveying information, it's about transferring or trying to explain where I am personally on this journey and what this journey's doing to me, because I think it's not just Dante being narcissistic. I think there are, you know, undertones of reality that hopefully every stone I'm uncovering, I find another worm of truth. That's a new term I'll coin right there. Worm of truth. Anyway, two things happened to me in the last few weeks. One was I got into this discussion with an individual, and I started by making a blanket statement saying, we Protestants, and he cut me off, and he's like, well, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Baptist. And I was like, what? Huh? What? Excuse moi? And he went on to make some sort of case of how Protestantism is only from, you know, the Lutheran branch of the Reformation and yada, yada, yada. And two things kind of came to the surface in this conversation. One, like, I didn't care. I'm using the word Protestantism as a catch-all, and I kind of felt like that was implied. We weren't trying to debate the history of the Christian church. We were talking about something else, and I was just using it as a reference point. But my friend doesn't think that way. And I realized as I was talking to him that if we're children, I see God as the mother that says, hey, go play outside. And I run outside and I find myself in a big mud pool. And I'm slapping around, having a great time in the mud pool, flecks of mud are flying up, getting into my eyes, and sometimes I cry because I'm all dirty and blind from the mud, and sometimes I'm having just a gay old time, and other times I'm drowning in my mud pool because I can't seem to find dry ground at all. And it's an infuriating process, but it's also, you know, it's a fun playground. That's just kind of how I see the world. It's a bunch of grays, it's a bunch of muddy heaps. Whereas my friend, he seems to have this way to look at the world where God sends him out, Mother God sends him out to play as a youngster in the backyard, and his backyard is a blacktop, and Protestantism means a certain thing, and we have to all agree on that meaning. There's a right and there's a wrong way to agree on that meaning. And I, you know, there's validity to that, obviously, right? We have to agree on the meaning of words to get anywhere in life. Modernism makes sense. But there was also, like, a sense in me of, like, dude, man, get past the walls of semantics and get to true communication. Heart to heart, man, heart to heart. Hear my heart here. It's not about the definition of the word Protestantism. So there was that. And then the other experience I had, my church is putting on a 4-week Tuesday night kind of Bible study thing, and it's named, provocatively, Making Sense of Jesus. Now, I took this to heart and made some assumptions about what the class would be about based on that title. So my wife and I went to the first week, and the whole first night of it, it's a 4-week class, the whole first night is essentially an apologetic. Here's the reasons for believing in a historical Jesus Christ. Here's the logical progression. Here's 5 true statements that we can defend morally, logically, rationally. And okay, maybe this didn't have impact on me because all that information was very familiar to me, so it wasn't new. But it got to a point, there was one slide that was thrown on the screen, and it was portraying the evangelical epistemological worldview lens, essentially trying to say in what order an evangelical Christian processes information. And the slide was presenting that first, the most important way you view all truth, you view all things, is as scripture being the highest authority. And then second, after that, was church tradition and something else I can't remember. And then the thing of least importance, it was church tradition and reason, which is fair. And the thing that ended up being of least importance on this epistemology screenshot was personal experience. And I looked at that and I just had to shake my head. And I kind of, without realizing it, rejected it. And it wasn't until my wife and I were talking on the way home that she very presciently explained the situation that our generation, her and I, aren't modernists. We are postmoderns. So part of my kind of a little bit of a stomach churning through this presentation was like, I didn't see the relevancy in taking this long to explain the historical validity of Christ, at least not to this room of people. This wasn't a room of people that was going to be doubting the historicity of Jesus Christ. These were Christian people, mostly, if not all, of the people in the room were people that already went to our church. So I wasn't seeing the relevance in this information, A. And B, I do weight my personal experience and I weight my emotions. And I don't think that's wrong. So I know a couple weeks ago when I did my Raw episode, I threw a bunch of arrows at postmodernism. But now I bring you back, postmoderns. I bring you back. Let's embrace. I am one of you. Now, I can't get all the way there all the time. So I stick my foot halfway in the postmodernist door because I want things to be coherent and relevant and emotionally satisfying. If they're not those things, then I don't super care if they're right or wrong. If it's not relevant, its truth is not consequential. Now, I say, once again, I'm only sticking my foot halfway in that postmodern door because I still believe in narrative, and I'm still, even though I hate systematic theology, I'm still looking for a narrative and a system that can make sense of all the dissonant parts and disparate angles of the gospel and of the Bible and of the worldview of Christianity. That's really why we're doing this series. After the music here, we'll get into the meat of it. Right now. So, what is an angel? Why is this important? Why is this relevant? Because I was thinking to myself, and I wanted to do a different episode 2 of God of Gods, but I was thinking to myself, anyone that was listening to this Elohim discussion we had last time isn't going to be stripped of their gut inclination. If they've been around the church at all, or if they have any inkling of Protestantism in them, they're just like, okay, Elohim. What you mean by the word Elohim is angel. You're not saying it, but Elohim are angels. So today's episode, we're looking at the etymology and use of the various Hebrew and Greek words to describe angels in the Old and New Testament. Primarily, we're going to stick in the Old, but we'll dalliance in the New real quickly as well. Many of us who were raised in Christianese, when we hear about ghosts or even something like vampires or werewolves, and there's some validity to that experience, we automatically think, okay, my worldview doesn't accept ghosts. Therefore, what this really must be is a demon. And what's a demon? A demon's a fallen angel. What's a fallen angel? Well, see, when God created the heavens and the earth, he also created angelic beings, heavenly beings that are spirit and not corporeal bodies like us. Now, there was some disagreement in heaven, and Lucifer, one of the head archangels, had some sort of spat with God, and God sent he and a third of the angels who agreed with Lucifer down out of heaven. They're cast out of heaven onto earth. So the serpent we see in Genesis 3, Satan, Lucifer, same dude, fallen angel. And the history of the world up until the very end is Satan causing a bunch of problems for us humans and God conquering time and time again. That's a general worldview. Does the Bible support that? I'm going to try to make a case here that the Elohim are not necessarily angels. And we're seeking an answer to the question, what is an angel? And therefore, what is not an angel? Alright, I want to start by mentioning this fun, kind of mysterious couple of verses in a otherwise not mysterious book at all, the Epistle to the Ephesians by the Apostle Paul. He writes in chapter 3 of his letter to the Ephesians. I'll just read verses 8 through 10. This is Paul writing once again. To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was given, to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God, who created all things, so that through the church the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. Did you catch that? He wants to make known the wisdom of God to the authorities of the heavenly places. Now, if you're an angel in the heavenly places, don't you know the manifold wisdom of God? Isn't that, you're not ignorant of that, right? Anywho, on that note, let's get into our word study here. Now, this can get very pedantic, and I'm going to try my best to just breeze through this information. I'm either going to go too fast or too slow. I don't know which one. But I tried to read every single verse in the Bible that related to angels or the angelic realm. I did this by doing some word studies. Once again, I used blueletterbible.org, which is a great website for, once again, looking at the original Greek and Hebrew words in context and how they're translated. It's awesome. So, angel is pretty straightforward. In the Old Testament, we have one word that's generally translated as angel. And in the New Testament, we have one word that's generally translated as angel. Easy peasy. And make it even easier, in the Greek New Testament, the word is angelos. Straightforward. Let's start our work, though, with the Old Testament word for angel, or the word we translate as angel from the Old Testament. This is the Hebrew word malak, or malak. Sorry, I don't know Hebrew, so forgive me if you do know Hebrew and you know I'm mispronouncing these words. Now, if you're a churchy, a Bible scholar, someone that's familiar with their biblical text, where would you expect to first see an angel? Probably right near the beginning, right? The fall of Adam and Eve. We would expect to hear something about an angel there. The word malak is nowhere to be found there. In fact, the first time in the Bible that the word is ever used is in Genesis 28. Here we go. Genesis 28, verses 10 through 12. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the Malachim, which is the plural of Malach, of God, were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, that's I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. So, Jacob's ladder. Classic story. We see angels, Malachim, ascending and descending this ladder to heaven. Great. Classic story fits our definition of angel, which, by the way, we're either picturing small little women like Touched by an Angel style, or G.I. Joe scary winged angels, or little babies that are flying around. Those are kind of like the three images of angels that we tend to have. So take your pick, whatever you want. I'm not going to argue with you right now. Anywho, the next time we see the word Malach is just a few chapters later in Genesis 32. I'll read from verse 3. And Jacob sent the Malach, or the Malachim, before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, Thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, blah, blah, blah. Verse 6. And the Malach returned to Jacob, saying, We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. Huh. So, you're telling me that Jacob sent angels to go communicate with his brother? That seems weird. Over in the book of Numbers, Numbers 20:14, we see Moses sending angels from Kadesh to the king of Edom, saying, Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that we have met, etc., etc., etc. In the book of Joshua, when the Israelites send out spies into the land, they're also called Malach. In the book of Judges, everybody is constantly sending out Malach to go tell messages, to go send messages from one to another. Now, if you're confused at all, don't worry, just read these passages in your English translations. Genesis 32, verse 3, And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, verse 6, and the messengers returned to Jacob. In Numbers 20:14, Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. So here's what we get. There are 214 uses of the word Malach in the Old Testament. In our English translations, or at least the ESV, it's pretty much evenly split. We have 111 uses of the word in English, angel, 98 uses of Malach translated as messenger or messengers, and 4 or 5 times the word Malach is translated as ambassador. So how can angel mean spiritual being created by God and just regular old messenger? How can it be both? What's going on here? To make matters worse or more complicated, there's also this intriguing character called the Angel of the Lord. Now, if you're familiar with like the New Testament angels, when they show up, everybody gets scared and sometimes they bow down and the angels say, Don't be afraid and don't worship me. I'm just a servant like you. That's kind of their byline. But the angel of the Lord is different. He seems to accept praise. He seems to accept glory. The angel of the Lord, he seems to show up mostly in the Torah, the first 5 books of the Old Testament. And I'm actually going to read a section here in Exodus where it doesn't specifically say the angel of the Lord, but it does say angel. Check this out. Exodus 23, verses 20 through 25. This is Yahweh speaking. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression. For my name is in him. What does that mean? But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods, their Elohim, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars into pieces.
You shall serve the Lord your God. You shall serve Yahweh your Elohim, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. Okay, let's just cut to the chase here. The angel of the Lord seems to be the second person of the Trinity, Jesus in what we Bible folk call the pre-incarnate form, right? We believe in a God in three persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Angel of the Lord seems to be a good example of Jesus here. There's a couple of reasons why we say this. One, because right here God's saying, he's got my name. God never says that of us. He never says, yo, Adam, your last name's Yahweh. You're Adam Yahweh. You know, we're made in his image, but we're not him. We don't share names. But this angel or messenger does. So now we have a cross-section where our traditional definition of angel is really compromised. For one, we see a certain angel that is worshipped, like God as God. And then on the other hand, we see angels that clearly aren't angels in the heavenly realms type of angels, but people. People are called angels. Check out further this short little verse in 2 Samuel 19:27. This is Mephibosheth, one of King Saul's sons, talking to him, and they're having kind of a back and forth here. But then in verse 27, Mephibosheth says to Saul, concerning David, I believe. Let me read this here. I'm going to read in the King James Version because in this particular case, the translation is different from my Bible, the ESV, and I'll say why here in a moment. Mephibosheth says to his father, and he, David, hath slandered thy servant unto my lord the king. But my lord the king is an angel of God. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes. My lord the king is an angel of God. Now Saul, King Saul, is called an angel. Now to be clear, I read out of King James because my ESV adds a word in there that doesn't appear to be in the original Hebrew, and that's like. In my ESV, it's quoted as, my lord the king is like an angel of God. Tricky. Throwing it in there. Not to confuse us, clearly. But that's not really what Mephibosheth said, did he? He called Saul an angel. Oh, and just so we're all on the same page with the angel of the Lord, here's Judges 13:20, no context needed. And when the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord went up in the flame of the altar. Now Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell on their faces to the ground. The angel of the Lord was in the fire, and he ascended. That's otherworldly. That's not something a human does. Lastly, from the Old Testament, Malachi 3:1. Behold, I send my Malach, and he will prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the Malach of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. This is a prophecy. This is a prophecy in which the word Malach is used twice, and I think the first time it's referring to John the Baptist, and the second time it's referring to Jesus. John the Baptist being the Malach, the messenger that prepares the way before, and the Malach of the covenant, the messenger of the covenant, the angel of the covenant being Jesus himself. Now, we get a different picture of angels in the New Testament. There clearly seems to be an idea of the classical angelic realm, heavenly host version of angels in the New Testament. Before Jesus is born, we see Gabriel appearing to the shepherds, to Mary, and to the shepherds. He's in the midst of a myriad of angels, the host of heaven in the sky, singing. Obviously, in the book of Revelation, we get all the angels blasting their trumpets and whatnot. In Matthew 22, some bad dudes are trying to trap Jesus in a contradiction or make him align with one party or the other, the Pharisees or the Sadducees, and Jesus squirms out of it by saying angels don't marry in heaven, which is very interesting for a reason we'll probably not get into today. But hold that note. Angels don't breed. Fascinating. After Jesus is tempted by Satan, and Satan says, throw yourself off this cliff and angels will catch you, Jesus is later ministered by angels and refreshed in spirit. In Matthew 13:49, Jesus says, at the end of days, angels will sever the wicked from the just. In chapter 16, verse 49 of Matthew, Jesus says, the Son of Man will come with angels at the final judgment. Interestingly, though, lest you think the New Testament is wholly divorced from the word Moloch in the Old Testament, in Luke 9:52, Jesus sends out messengers ahead of him, so our English translations say, to enter a village of the Samaritans and to make preparations for Jesus. Well, obviously, in context of this story, he's not sending out heavenly angels to prepare a place for him. Jesus is sending out messengers, humans. But the word in Greek is angelos, angels. So here again, just like in the Old Testament, we see angels being used as a catch-all for messengers. There's a bunch of stuff about angels in the New Testament. That affirms our classical idea of heavenly angels. There's a healing angel in John that comes down to a certain pool every season, and whoever goes into that pool first gets healed by this angel. It's super trippy and weird. Now, we see a very interesting idea arise in Acts chapter 23. Paul's making a speech, and once again, he's trying to pit the Pharisees versus the Sadducees, because both don't like him, but he doesn't want to die and be imprisoned or whatever, so here's what happens. Starting in verse 6. Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I'm a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. "We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke with him?" Whoa! Did you catch that? There's a difference between spirits and angels. There's a difference between spirits and angels. There's a difference between spirits and angels. What does that mean? Again, my little 8-year-old brain's freaking out because I thought that all ghosts were demons in disguise. And what's a demon? A fallen angel. But here, there's angels and there's spirits, and they seem to be different. Paul asserts this bluntly, though it's not his direct point, in Romans. Famous verse, Romans 8:38, "For I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." Not clear enough? Ephesians 6:12, probably an equally well-known verse. Again, this is Paul. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." Notice, the word angel is not used in describing the demonic realm here. Paul's saying, as Christians, we're fighting not against other people. We're fighting against authorities, cosmic powers, present darkness, spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Why doesn't he use the word angel? Why doesn't he say fallen angels? "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against fallen angels." He doesn't say that. Now, okay, I'm drawing to a point here, and that is the word angel is never associated with demons, is never associated with, quote, fallen angels. You cannot draw a direct line between the words Moloch or Angelus and angels, with a couple exceptions. Here's the two exceptions. 2 Corinthians 12:7. This is Paul speaking again. "So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited." That's my ESV translation. Of course, the word there in Greek is angelos, an angel of Satan to harass me. We also see Satan with his angels in Revelation 12. But there is one big exception, and that is told both in 2 Peter and Jude. Now, there's a ton here to unpack, but we don't have time today. But we gotta at least broach it real quickly. 2 Peter 2:4 reads, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment." Okay, Jude says a similar thing here in verse 6. and the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. Ring, ring, ring. There's your fallen angels. There's your fallen angels. We get angels. They did something wrong. God cast them down, right? Not exactly. Because when we picture fallen angel, we equate the phrase fallen angels with demons. But the difference is we see demons running around all the time in the New Testament. They're possessing people. They're doing bad, mischievous things all the time. Also, by the way, they don't have bodies. Remember, when the legion is cast out of the one dude with the chains, they need some place to go, so Jesus casts them into pigs. They're bodiless, incorporeal things, the demons. Whereas every time we see angels, they seem to have bodies of their own. That aside, these angels, the ones that got out of their place of authority, are currently in chains until the final judgment. Now, both Jude and 2 Peter are borrowing from a story from 1 Enoch and the Book of Jubilees and other extra canonical stories. We're going to get into those later. Those are super relevant to this whole God of Gods thing, but it's not for today. Today, we're making a simple point. Angels are not equitable to fallen angels. They're not equitable to demons. Demons, the word demon, is never used in conjunction with the word angel. Similarly, there's good angels, and we have a couple classes of them defined, right, in our nomenclature. We have cherubim and seraphim. The only problem, when those things show up in the Bible, they're not called angels. The cherubim are like these guardian creatures. They show up in Genesis 3. They guard the entrances of Eden with flaming swords, but they are not called angels. They are not called malach. In 2 Samuel 22, there's this image of God riding on cherubim, like chariots of fire, and instead of horses, we have cherubim. In Ezekiel 28, one of the two weird passages in the Old Testament that may be describing an origin story of Satan, the satanic character, if we believe that to be what it's describing, is called a cherubim, or it was once a cherubim. But again, cherubim are not ever called malach. And of course, cherubim are on either side of the mercy seat in the temple, in between which God sits on his throne. Seraphim is from the root word seraph, which can also describe a fiery serpent. So remember when the Israelites are bitten by serpents? That's actually the same word, seraphim, as we see in Isaiah 6, this wonderful, magical, heavenly vision of these things flying with six wings, wings that cover their feet and their eyes. But again, those seraphim aren't called angels. Well, okay, what about Michael and Gabriel? Well, both of them show up in Daniel, but Michael in Daniel is called a chief prince. This is not to say that Michael isn't an angel, because he is referred to such in Revelation, and Gabriel in Luke is obviously also an angel. But interesting to note that neither are called archangels in the Old Testament. Now, are there any other heavenly beings that have names that we should talk about? Yeah, there's a few. There's Nephilim, which we're going to deal with on a later episode. There is the Prince of Persia. So there's this weird encounter where Daniel's praying for 3 weeks, and then this dude comes to him, bright, shining man, so presumably an angel. But he says, "Sorry, I tried to get to you sooner, but I was held up by the Prince of Persia." This could potentially have big meaning and will have a ripple effect on where we're going with this series as we move on. But that's that. We also see heavenly creatures, you know, like with foreheads and all, and bodies of lions and like different animal parts in Revelations, the guys that sing holy, holy, holy. And then lastly, we have beings that are referred to as the Watchers. Now, they only show up in a couple obscure passages in the Old Testament, but they show up in a buttload of non-biblical ancient Mesopotamian stories. So we're going to talk about them later. Now, guys, I know I got kind of bogged down in this word study here, but I think the point is really relevant, and I know it's just a simple point, and we're spending a lot of time to reinforce the simple point, but we got to make it. We have Elohim. And Elohim are never called angels. We have demons. Demons are never called angels. We have humans that are called angels. And we have God himself, who in one form is called an angel. I think an angel is not an ontological term, but it's a term of profession or occupation. Anyone who is carrying a message in the Bible, I think, is referred to as an angel. Therefore, lots of things can be angels. Angels of Satan, as we read that Paul said, were those who were carrying a message from Satan. The angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, is Jesus carrying God the Father's message. My computer's dying. I gotta run out here. I wanted to talk about the word Satan in the Old Testament, but I can't. Just rest assured, it's also not associated with the word angel. Also, might not be a proper name at all, weirdly. Oh, sons of God. Also sons of God in the Old Testament. Not called angels. Okay, I've beaten this down. We're ready to make some deeper headway here, but I needed us to strip our image of angel and fallen angel out of our mind in order to make progress here. Hopefully we've done that. My name's Dante Stack, signing out. Peace be the journey.